Today is Monday, January 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. With President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration just days away, the Capitol prepares.
25,000 National Guard troops and thousands of law enforcement officers from other agencies will guard the nation's capital.
Plus, record heat is fueling climate change.
The meaning of having all these very hot, hot years is that it's a clear signal that climate change is continuing.
We'll have these stories and more next. Police and National Guard troops around the United States are standing sentry at newly fortified state houses. The move comes ahead of expected demonstrations planned for the lead-up to President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. AP correspondent Ben Thomas starts us off.
Mounted police patrolled outside the state capitol in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, while National Guard troops rolled up in Humvees. There were similar scenes at state houses around the country and a massive presence in Washington, D.C., where the National Mall has been closed and fencing and other barricades thrown up to keep people away from the U.S. Capitol. The deterrence efforts appear to be keeping numbers small, though armed protesters were seen in locations including Columbus, Ohio, and Lansing, Michigan. Timothy Teagan showed up there with a rifle, but said he wanted
to urge a message of peace and unity to the left and right.
This is nothing new here in Michigan.
Lieutenant Brian Oleksik of the Michigan State Police.
It's a different topic, and it's a serious topic. We won't tolerate criminal behavior.
I'm Ben Thomas.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation is issuing new security warnings ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. In addition, Congress is considering proposals to establish a national bipartisan commission to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol building. Patsy Wittikaswara has that part of the story.
FBI Director Christopher Wray.
And the reason I use the word potential is because one of the real challenges in this space is trying to distinguish what's aspirational versus what's intentional.
The FBI has identified more than 270 suspects and arrested more than 100 people in connection to the January 6th bloody takeover of the U.S. Capitol by supporters of President Donald Trump. Perpetrators were fueled by the false narrative that the election was stolen. Some have been identified as current or former police or military. Former FBI agent and Brennan Center for Justice fellow Michael German.
This is a problem that has been persistent throughout our history, and that is the association of some members of the military and some law enforcement officers with white supremacist and far-right militant groups.
25,000 National Guard troops and thousands of law enforcement officers from other agencies will guard the nation's capital. Vice President Mike Pence reassured Americans the inauguration will be safe.
That President-elect Joe Biden, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris are sworn in as the new president and vice president of the United States in a manner consistent with our history, with our traditions.
Meanwhile, investigations continue, including whether some members of Congress aided the attack by giving tours of the Capitol the day before.
If, in fact, it is found that members of Congress were accomplices to this insurrection, if they aided and abetted the crime, there may have to be actions taken beyond the Congress and in terms of prosecution.
Lawmakers have introduced a bill that would establish a bipartisan commission to investigate the attack and address key questions, such as whether there was a failure of intelligence and possible involvement of political officials. Amy Zagart is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University.
What was the reaction? What was the response? What were critical lessons learned and failures from the response? And what should we take away as a nation in building that a unity of narrative, a unity of experience, so that we have a basis on which to come together again?
Because of security concerns, inauguration rehearsals has been postponed from Sunday to Monday. Patsy Wittikaswara, VOA News.
Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was arrested at a Moscow airport as he tried to return to the country after being in Germany. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers reports.
Navalny's return comes after spending 5 months recovering from nerve agent poisoning that he blames on the Kremlin. According to Russia's prison service, Putin's foe was detained for violating parole terms from a suspended sentence on a 2014 embezzlement conviction. The prison service said he would be held in custody until a court rules on his case. The service earlier said that it would seek to have Navalny serve his 3.5-year sentence behind bars. Navalny brushed off concerns about the arrest as he boarded the plane in Berlin, saying he was an innocent man. I'm Karen Chemes.
Unknown gunmen shot and killed two female judges in Kabul on Sunday as they traveled to work. Reuters' Emily Wither has the details.
Police say no one has claimed responsibility for the early morning ambush that also saw their driver wounded. A spokesman for the Taliban said its fighters were not involved. Local media said the women who work for the Supreme Court were on their way to the office when they were attacked. There's been a surge in violence in Afghanistan despite peace talks between the government and the Taliban. Targeted killings of journalists, government officials and rights activists have increased rapidly in recent months. It comes as international donors and governments express concern on the progress of women's rights. Gains have been made over the last two decades, but as foreign troops prepare to withdraw from the country next year, there's fears those gains could be reversed if the Taliban returns to any sort of power.
That was Reuters reporter Emily Wither. The World Meteorological Organization warns record-setting global temperatures are accelerating the pace of human-induced climate change. Lisa Schlein has more.
Global data show 2020 was one of the three warmest years on record, closely rivaling 2016, which narrowly holds the top spot. The World Meteorological Organization says the past decade was the warmest on record, encompassing six of the world's hottest years. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis tells VOA the record-setting temperature events indicate a persistent long-term climate change trend.
The meaning of having all these very hot years is that it's a clear signal that climate change is continuing. There's no sign of it easing off at all, quite the contrary. So climate change is real. It's not a future scenario. It's happening now, and it's not going to go away, unfortunately, anytime soon.
Meteorologists say the Earth is 1.2 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial levels. At this rate, they warn, temperatures could rise by 3 to 5 degrees Celsius this century, which they say would be catastrophic. Temperature is just one of the indicators of climate change. The underlying cause is high levels of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. Nullis says global warming has resulted in unprecedented extreme weather events in every region of the world, among them sustained heat and wildfires in Siberia.
We're seeing the melting of Arctic sea ice, the retreat of glaciers. These are contributing to accelerating sea level rise, which in turn has a knock-on effect that when we see, you know, extreme events like hurricanes, the impacts of those hurricanes are bigger because sea levels are higher.
The WMO says La Niña, a naturally occurring cooling climate phenomenon, put a brake on 2020's record-setting heat at the end of the year. La Niña is expected to continue into the early to mid part of this year. However, meteorologists note La Niña's cooling effect is only temporary. They say Britain's Met Office annual global temperature forecast suggests 2021 is likely to be one of Earth's hottest years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And coming up later,
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
While NASA recently announced the extension of its Mars InSight mission, one aspect of the lander's work has ended without accomplishing its goal. According to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a self-burrowing probe called the Mole was to hammer to about 5 meters beneath the surface of Mars to take the planet's internal temperature. The Mole has been trying to make its way into the red planet since February 2019, but because of Martian soil properties, was unable to gain the friction it needed to get beyond 2 or 3 centimeters deep. On January 9th, the Mole conducted 500 additional hammer blows to try to get beneath the surface. Despite the hard work, the probe wasn't able to make any progress, so the Mole's team called an end to their efforts. Other aspects of the InSight mission will continue. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. In Uganda, the party of opposition leader Bobby Wine said Sunday that it was preparing to challenge President Yoweri Museveni's election victory and condemned what it called the house arrest of Bobby Wine and his wife. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Halima Athumanin in Kampala.
While the NRM got the majority of legislators who were voted in, according to the figures, 316 National Resistance Movement Party legislators were voted in. But then, one thing that you need to know is that some members of the ruling party lost, and these were people who had been, you know, in these offices for over 2 or 3 or 4 terms, and this also includes the vice president of the country who lost the elections. We had some ministers who lost the elections. So it was such a big blow for the ruling party, mainly because some of the big people who actually lost the elections were losing it to a political party that has been in politics for barely 3 months.
I want to switch gears and talk about election security. As we know, Bobby Wine and his party have disputed the results, rejected the results, citing election irregularities. But President Museveni addressed the nation and said that everything was free and fair.
I think this may turn out to be the most cheating-free election since 1962.
So what can you tell us about the accusations that are being made about voting irregularities?
There are questions of, if these elections were free and fair, why was the internet shut down? If these elections were free and fair, why did we have to see the military try to chase people away from the polling sessions where previously, you know, every time they were counting these votes, people would stand vote with the electoral official, with the polling agent. But this time round, that is not the case. So as far as the National Unity Platform are concerned, they say they reject the results. They think that they say that according to the National Unity Platform, they are saying that a minority clique is forcing themselves on the majority of Ugandans, and it's something that they are not going to accept. They are going to resist and are going to say no to using every using every avenue provided in the law. So according to them, they do have the evidence of ballot stuffing and other forms of electoral malpractice.
Now, President Museveni has said that there is no ballot stuffing, but the United States State Department released a statement on January 16th saying that they were deeply troubled by the many credible reports of security force violence during the pre-election period and election irregularities during the polls, and they strongly urged independent, credible, impartial, and thorough investigations into the reports. I want to circle back also to something else, and this is to Bobby Wine. It was reported widely on Friday that the army or security forces had surrounded his home. What is the latest update on that?
The military actually was not just there on Friday. They started right on Thursday, actually, because we were there in the evening. So according to the National Unity Platform, they say that they believe that Bobby Wine is effectively under house arrest. And today, when they were holding their press conference, they asked the government to charge Bobby Wine and not to use his residence as a detention center. According to them, they say that they think Bobby Wine's crime is winning seven. So yes, right now, Bobby Wine is still under detention. What we know is that they're not even allowing anyone with groceries to get to him. They're not allowing anyone out of the house, because right now, I think it's just him, his wife, and their guard who are locked up in the house.
From Kampala, Uganda, it was Halima Athumanin. 2 years ago, in January of 2019, the World Health Organization said vaccine hesitancy was among the top 10 threats to global health. That was before COVID-19 spread around the globe. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us how doctors are working to overcome the problem.
Even though scientists race to find a vaccine, persuading people to take it could be a problem. Two recent surveys, one from the Pew Research Center and the other from Gallup, put the number of Americans not wanting to get the vaccine between 37% and 40%. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the leading infectious disease expert in the U.S., estimates that herd immunity could require as much as 85% vaccine coverage. In Philadelphia, about half of the emergency technicians and fire department medics have chosen not to get the vaccine. Philadelphia Fire Commissioner Adam Thiel says education is the key to getting them on board.
We hope that over time, as more people are vaccinated and we get more education out there, that more of our members will receive the vaccine, be willing to receive the vaccine.
African Americans have one of the highest rates of COVID infection and death in the U.S., according to the CDC. Yet surveys show only 4 out of 10 Black Americans said they would be vaccinated, compared with 8 out of 10 Asian Americans and 6 in 10 white and Hispanic Americans. Demetrio Olivieri is with the Philadelphia Fire Department.
Minorities are leery about it, and we have a right to be leery about it.
Public health experts are calling for targeted information campaigns. April Timms is a clinical neuropsychologist who has studied the impact of racism on science and health.
We need to do better at rectifying this problem so that people do participate.
Doctors who belong to the American Board of Internal Medicine are posting photos and videos of themselves getting the COVID vaccine. It's part of a campaign by the American Board of Internal Medicine to convince people that it's safe. Dr. Richard Barron heads this organization.
We're hoping that doctors in this country have enough webs of relationships with their families, with their patients, with their communities, that if they step up and lead and show people that they are not only willing to do this, but proud of it and encouraging other people to do it, we hope that will be part of the very broad campaign that we all need to get to a place where most of us have had.
Given the soaring U.S. infection rate and the enormous death toll, the need is urgent. In California, Disneyland is hosting a mass vaccination site. In Arizona, the National Guard has stepped in to help at vaccination sites. The pandemic will end only when the vaccine in a bottle gets into people's arms. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
AFRICOM spokesperson Colonel Christopher P. Carnes confirms to VOA's Somali service that the repositioning of troops from Somalia was completed ahead of the January 15th presidential directive. U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the troop removal in early December last year. The number of U.S. military personnel in Somalia ranged between 650 and 800 U.S. troops supported and mentored the elite Somali unit known as Danab Lightning. U.S. military officials earlier said that most of the personnel will be repositioned in the region. Billionaire Richard Branson's Virgin Orbit reached space for the first time Sunday with a successful test of its air-launched rocket. It delivered 10 NASA satellites to orbit and achieved a key milestone after aborting the rocket's first test launch last year. North Korea has unveiled what it says is a new submarine-launched ballistic missile. It's the latest apparent development in North Korea's fast-advancing weapons program. Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Wearing a shiny black leather jacket and fur hat, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un presided over another military parade in Pyongyang. It's North Korea's second parade in 3 months. This time, the North unveiled what their officials say is a new submarine-launched ballistic missile, or SLBM. SLBMs add an unpredictable component to North Korea's arsenal. They are mobile, potentially increasing the range of North Korea's ballistic missile arsenal. They are also easier to hide. The newest missile has not been tested, But retired South Korean Lieutenant General Chun In-bum warns that could soon change.
Instead of shooting one, they're showing it to us. And they're basically telling us what they intend on doing. And so the next obvious step would be to demonstrate.
The rapid development of SLBM technology is puzzling to some defense experts. Chun says that's because North Korea does not currently have a functional submarine capable of shooting ballistic missiles.
What we know for sure is that North Korea is continuing with its nuclear program now to include a submarine-launched ballistic missile with nuclear warheads. And with that capability, they will either have a second, a strike capability or to intimidate the United States in its policies towards Korean Peninsula.
But it is not clear how close North Korea is to deploying even a single nuclear-capable submarine, much less a fleet of submarines that could threaten the U.S. mainland. Instead, some say the North could soon test the massive intercontinental ballistic missile it unveiled at its October parade. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Monday is a national holiday in the United States honoring the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He led the nonviolent struggle in the 1950s and 1960s to promote civil rights and end racial segregation in America until his murder in April of 1968. Dr. King's effective use of nonviolent methods was largely inspired by an Indian, Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi. His own Hindu-inspired activism and philosophy helped colonial India wrest independence from Britain in 1948. VOA's Adam Phillips looks back at the civil rights legend.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
That's Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, delivered to a 250,000 civil rights marchers in Washington, D.C., an iconic moment in recent American history. Much of the spirit of that plea for justice was rooted in the experience of Mohandas Gandhi, a continent and a generation away. In 1893, as a young Indian lawyer in South Africa, Gandhi was ejected from the first-class train seat he had paid for and told to sit among the other non-whites in third class. David Courtwright, the author of Gandhi and Beyond, says that was a moment that would profoundly affect the world.
Gandhi recognized early on the self-defeating nature of violence, how violence begets violence, and there is a cycle of action and reaction. Whenever we strike a blow, the other person will strike back. This vicious cycle of violence, Gandhi recognized that we had to break out of it.
Like Gandhi, who was a Hindu, Dr. Martin Luther King, a Christian minister, based his political activism on his religion. Just as Gandhi's Hinduism teaches that all human beings, even one's enemies or oppressors, are an expression of the divine with no less value than oneself, Reverend King and his followers were inspired by Jesus' command to turn the other cheek when your enemy strikes you, and to pray for him, suffer for him, and ultimately to forgive him.
Dr. King used to say that we will match your ability to inflict suffering by our willingness to suffer.
That's Andrew Young, the first African-American ambassador to the United Nations and one of King's closest friends and lieutenants. He has just finished watching Dare Not Walk Alone, a film documentary about the civil rights movement that includes footage from a nonviolent demonstration he led in 1964 in St. Augustine, Florida, as a young leader in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
And now I'm watching myself getting kicked and stomped. There was a picture of a young woman with a broken nose. I'm sure her nose is beautiful again. And she looks upon that physical beating as a mark of courage, as I do, that you were willing to confront evil and risk your life and not back down. The willingness to suffer for what you believe in is one of the highest virtues.
Like Andrew Young, Gandhi and King keenly understood that the moral dignity of nonviolent demonstrations, as conveyed through the media, could powerfully affect public opinion. Economic pressure through boycotts was another way that Dr. King's methods echoed those of Gandhi. Young recalls the 90 days of demonstrations and boycotts against segregated department stores in downtown Birmingham, Alabama in 1963.
We never hit anybody. We never cussed anybody out. We never broke any windows. But we every day challenged the philosophy of racism in a way that it stopped economic enterprise, at least temporarily, so that the business community had to come to us after about 100 days and say, look, this has got to stop because you're putting us out of business. You are the aggressor with nonviolence in that you are defining the issue. You are staging the confrontation.
Gandhi and King's methods have inspired political movements around the world. One thinks of the reconciliation efforts in post-apartheid South Africa and the Dalai Lama's efforts on behalf of Tibetans.
Robert Barnett, who founded the Department of Contemporary Tibetan Studies at Columbia University in New York, notes
that the Dalai Lama paid tribute to Gandhi and his nonviolent method when he accepted his 1989 Nobel Peace Prize.
And there he's spoken quite a lot about compassion and trying to understand why Chinese people felt in the way they did when they took over China, and trying to go from that to saying we need to negotiate with these people and talk with these people, not to use violence against them.
The universality of what Gandhi called the force of truth and love is why Andrew Young says that Martin Luther King Day should not be regarded as only a holiday for African Americans.
Martin Luther King happened to be an Afro-American, but the message there is that we ought to be celebrating and studying nonviolence as a continuing option for growth and development of human civilization.
Thoughts for all Americans and people everywhere to remember on this Martin Luther King Day 2020. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a magnificent Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has voiced concern over the Russian government's expanding repression of civil society. On December 28th, the Russian Ministry of Justice added five individuals, including prominent human rights activist Lev Ponomaryov, to a list of so-called foreign agents. The four others were journalist Lyudmila Savitskaya, newspaper editor Denis Kamalyagin, website journalist Sergei Markyalov, and artist and rights activist Daria Abakonchich. Savitskaya, Markyalov, and Kamalyagin have been contributors to the Russian service of RFERL, whose parent agency is the U.S. Agency for Global Media. The move by the Russian government marked the first time individuals, as opposed to organizations, were put on the Justice Ministry's registry, which subjects them to enhanced bureaucratic scrutiny, reporting requirements, financial audits, and harsh penalties if they fail to comply with the law's draconian requirements. Russia first passed a law in 2012 which allowed it to label foreign-funded NGOs and foreign-funded rights groups that it viewed as engaging in political activity as foreign agents. The law was later expanded to include media outlets and independent journalists. On December 31, 2020, President Vladimir Putin signed off on additional legislation that broadens the parameters under which a person or entity can be officially deemed a foreign agent and increases penalties, including possible prison time for individuals and organizations labeled foreign agents who fail to inform official entities about their status or refuse to report their activities. Amnesty International has called the legislation a new witch hunt of civil society groups and human rights defenders standing up for justice and dignity. U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Cale Brown said in a tweet that by its designation of the five individuals as media foreign agents, the Russian government is intensifying repression of its civil society in a threat against independent media. Deputy Spokesperson Brown also noted that Russia is adopting a series of new laws that significantly expand the government's power to further restrict freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of assembly, providing additional means to suppress uncomfortable facts and silence dissenting voices. Changes to the foreign agents law are particularly troubling, he added, allowing authorities to selectively apply onerous registration and labeling requirements, veto an organization's activities, and imprison those found in violation. We call on Russia to respect its citizens' rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.